Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
There are few figures in American politics who have been more influential in the evolution of our current debate than Grover Norquist, the founder of Americans for Tax Reform. His no-tax pledge has become a mantra for Republican candidates across the country and have created the context of the debates we see year in and year out in Congress and state legislatures. And I sat down with him to talk about taxes and the proper role of government. Grover Norquist, great to see you. Thank you. I know the evening we're taping this, you and our old buddy Austin Goolsbee are going to have a discussion about the Trump tax plan and
yes.
Fiscal policy at the University of Chicago, which should be fun. The two guys who competed for the title of the funniest celebrity in Washington.
Absolutely. Great fun.
Yeah. So, but it's good to have you here. I'm interested. We're about the same age, but came from somewhat different backgrounds. Tell me about your growing up in Weston, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Weston is about 12 miles due west of Boston. There was a hotel pub where you would stop and have lunch on your way to New York. You'd get 12 miles and that was lunch. It was a while ago. My parents grew up in Michigan and Western New York, Jamestown, and moved around and then basically stopped around in Boston. And I grew up in Weston, went to grade school and high school there, and then college, and
a little place called Harvard. But
yeah,
before we get there, let's not go. We don't want to breeze through this. Your dad was an executive at Polaroid.
Yes, he did a bunch of things in manufacturing, and at one point ran quality control for a number of years, and then purchasing.
And that was at the time when Polaroid was poor Polaroid. That was the sort of exciting technology of the day. You could take a picture and see it right away.
Yes. Steve Jobs talks about Dr. Land as his hero, and Polaroid was very exciting. It was a research lab attached to a company. My dad used to say he wanted to write a book entitled How to Bankrupt a Monopoly, because they were able to do that.
Today it's quaint to think about it, but it was hot stuff back then. I read somewhere that you guys had pretty rigorous requirements as kids, you and your, I guess, three siblings you had?
Three siblings, yeah.
To perform, to do some research and make presentations on a regular basis, is this right?
Well, the school asked us in third, fourth grade to do 30-second speeches and then one-minute speeches. And so my father, who'd done a lot of speech and debate in his high school out in Jamestown, New York, would get you to prepare. My first talk was on Wolverines because, of course, it was Sunday night and I informed my dad, I'm supposed to give a speech tomorrow. And we just watched something about Wolverines on the Walt Disney show. So I had to give a speech on Wolverines, went to dictionary and looked up more stuff on Wolverines. And the first time you do it, it takes about 5 minutes. And you had to get down to 30 seconds. So it was a lot of practicing. And it was very helpful for my dad to patiently let you do it again and again and again. And pretty soon you were saying more in 30 seconds than the first time out you're doing in a couple of minutes.
Yeah, it often works that way. And you got, I read, maybe this isn't true, but that became sort of that was not a one-off, that you guys, your family, that you, he asked you to do that, look and read the encyclopedia.
Yeah, and it was largely attached to stuff from school. They kept wanting to do speeches, but he practiced all of us on speech for speech class or drama class.
And Weston itself was a pretty prosperous community. Schools must have been really good.
I went there starting in kindergarten, went through high school, all in Weston. And yeah, I like the schools. It's a fairly interesting dynamic, a division between people who took it very seriously and people who didn't take schoolwork very seriously. And we had the folks who liked to play sports and the drama people and the...
And where were you?
I was a student because I was told you're supposed to. I played soccer in the fall, wrestling in the winter, and track in the spring. But also worked because I worked with the drama coach, who was the speech coach, or the speech teacher. He would let me be in each of the plays. I could be in the musical, even though I wasn't really much of a singer. So I would get a non-singing part in the musical, and then I would get a part in the Shakespeare play that they did in the fall. So it's fun. It's good practice.
And did it? So you learned how to speak and perform. So this is where your comedy career began as well?
No, I started doing comedy because a friend of mine, who's now at C-SPAN, he said, I'm going to go do 5 minutes at the DC Improv. Would you like to come? I said, sure. So I went with him. And he did his 5 minutes, and I said, well, how do you get onto the stage as an amateur to do 5 minutes? How do you sign up for something like that? He says, if you can come up with 15 jokes, half of which work, I'll get you on stage. I said, I'll start. So I had a little 3x5 card I kept in my wallet, and I'd write down things as they occurred to me. And then there's that funniest celebrity in D.C., which performed for maybe 20 years, and they would get D.C. celebrities, which are people you see on C-SPAN.
Yeah, right. Always hilarious, by the way. Whenever I want to be amused, I turn on C-SPAN because it's uproarious.
So we had, you know, congressmen, senators. Lieberman won 1 year. He beat Christopher Hitchens. Christopher Hitchens never forgave him for that. He used notes, which wasn't fair. And the late Senator Specter from...
Yeah.
Pennsylvania. I was in charge of getting Republicans to come on because they didn't get as many Republican congressmen senators. And they did ask me to do it when they heard I was looking to do some stand-up. They said, well, how would you like to perform? And I had 5 months to go. So I said, okay. And so I got ready. And it was okay. I did well. I didn't embarrass myself. And then they said...
Were you worried about it?
Well, I'd never...
I mean, it's hard to go up and... I mean, it's harder to go up and try and be funny than it is to... give a treatise on tax reform.
Yes. First of all, everybody is as much an expert as you are on what's funny. Matter of fact, they are the expert on whether they think it's funny. You don't have a vote in whether they think it's funny. If you talk about something you know, and they don't get it, might be their fault. But if I'm telling jokes and they don't think they're funny, it's not their fault. It's your fault. And also, it's tough to practice. Practice in front of who? So you have to have your own sense of what works. Your staff will either laugh with you or at you, but it's tough to get feedback from a handful of staff.
Or laugh with you when you're there and at you when you're not.
Yes. So it went well. It went okay so that I felt comfortable. I did it many years in a row because if I couldn't get enough Republican congressmen or other folks from the center-right, then I'd have to perform. So... I did it a number of years. Senator Specter performed. He told four or five of the longest shaggy dog, dirty stories, dirty jokes you've ever heard in your life. But when you're 70 years old and you do that, it's funny.
Yeah.
So it was great fun.
Of course, you got to wait a long time to tell them, though, if you got to wait till you're 70.
Yes, this is true. I don't think you could get away with it if you were 35.
Yeah.
So it's been fun, and I've just done a fair amount of it from time to time, just performed at Georgetown for 16 minutes at their first annual White House Correspondents' Dinner. So they're going to mimic the White House Correspondents' Dinner. They have an Institute of Politics like
yes,
Chicago's.
Yes, 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 yeah, yeah. We are working closely with them. So in terms of politics,
yeah.
Your folks, I read, were were kind of Rockefeller Republicans. And I grew up in New York during the Rockefeller period. I was a kid in the schools in New York during that period. He was not what I would describe, looking back today, a Grover Norquist Republican. In fact, I remember 1970 him passing this big bond issue in New York, and that was going to raise taxes, and it was very controversial, and people thought he was risking his political career by doing it. But your folks, that's where your folks were.
Well, my dad once did a picture of Thomas Dewey, who was Rockefeller before Rockefeller.
Yes.
And on a typewriter. So you do it with the shading. So now you do it on computers with, yeah, with little symbols or letters. He did it with a typewriter for Dewey.
That sounds harder than doing it on a computer.
It must have been a lot of work. It's pretty impressive stuff.
You still have that?
Dad does, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's I've seen it. It's cool. And I think they actually got it signed at one point.
Wow.
Some teacher got it to Dewey. They were moderate Republicans. Mm-hmm. The Rockefeller may be unfair.
I liked Rockefeller, yeah, so I'm not complaining.
He's just a pre-Reagan Republican. Yeah. So being a Republican used to mean you were born north of the Mason-Dixon line. And if you were south of the Mason-Dixon line, you were a Democrat. And it didn't tell you anything about your worldview on taxes or spending or the size or scope of government or foreign policy. But during Reagan's lifetime, the two parties have sorted themselves out to be much more coherent vehicles for expressing people's wishes. And if you have a more limited or constrained view of what the government ought to be doing to people or for people, then you tend to be a Republican. If you have a more expansive view of the role of the state and a more limited view of individuals' roles, then you're a Democrat. And the two are separated to the point where everything used to be bipartisan back in the 50s because the conservative Republican and the conservative Democrat would argue with the liberal Republican and the liberal Democrat. So all the votes on taxes, spending, regulations, civil rights, everything was bipartisan because the two parties shirts and skins didn't tell you anything. And as the two parties have sorted themselves out, there isn't a Republican in the House or Senate who'd vote for a tax increase. There isn't a Democrat who wouldn't. And the issue I tend to focus on taxes is the one that most clearly divides the two parties. There used to be moderate Democrats during the Reagan years who would vote against certain spending, but none of them would vote against a tax increase. But on spending, they might, or on labor union issues, stuff like that, they might have, or trial lawyers even, but not on taxes.
Well, Reagan himself signed 11 tax increases, I think.
Oh, yeah, and George Washington lost a bunch of battles. But that wasn't the purpose. Reagan never suggested a tax increase. He did get backed into a few, yeah. He didn't have the House the Senate.
We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah.
But although I take your point, sometimes it seems hard to describe either of these parties as completely coherent these days.
Much more than 30, 40, 50
years
ago.
I do take your point. Yeah. Your grandmother, I
had two. Which one are we thinking?
Your Swiss grandmother who, yes, introduced you to human events.
Yes, that's true. That's a true story. Yes.
Yes. So tell me about her and that.
My grandmother was from Switzerland, Stein on Rhine, and grew up in St. Louis and married my Swedish grandfather, which was a big scandal because all the Swedish girls in Jamestown had already laid claims and he went off and married a foreigner from St. Louis. So they were more conservative, and she would get human events and send four of them up. I guess it was a weekly publication, and every month they'd get four mailed up to our house, my parents' house, and I would read them. And go, I didn't see that on CBS. What's going on here?
Yeah. Well, that was really the voice of the right.
Yes, it was more political than National Review.
Yes. Yeah. They used to talk about totalitarian liberals and the leftist bias in academia and themes that are pretty mainstream on the right today, but were edgy or back back then. So what appealed to you about that, other than that it occurred to you that it wasn't on CBS?
Well, I became a conservative as an anti-communist. I was watching the role of the Soviet Union in the world, my public library in Weston got rid of all of their right-of-center books. So the I Led Three Lives by Herb Philbrick was sold off for a nickel, and I picked it up at the sale. And Witness by Whitaker Chambers went for about a quarter. They were purging all this stuff out of the public
basically
library.
Basically, you got priced into the conservative market here.
Yes. Well, trying to hide, get rid of this stuff, they made the mistake of giving it to me to read. So I was an anti-communist, and from that, it backed into the broader questions of the role of the state versus the individual, and how much liberty people should have and how much control the state should have. And you started at the pretty bloody edge of that question when you're looking at the Soviet Union, and then how does it move as you move towards more liberty and less statism?
And was that a fully formed philosophy by the time you got to Harvard?
I think so. When I was at Harvard, Harvard undergrad, 74 to 78, and there I joined the Harvard Republican Club and the Conservative Club, which had like three members, and the Libertarian Association.
You probably rise up quickly in that organization.
That's
huh?
right. You get to be an officer right away. the Harvard Sons of Liberty was the Harvard Libertarian Association when we elected Lita Cosmides, now a leading sociobiologist up at Stanford, to be president. She said, could we call it the Harvard Libertarian Association instead of Sons of Liberty? And so, yes, we did.
Yeah.
I was political. In college, somebody was telling me, yo, you're one of these Ayn Rand people. So I figured I'd better go read Ayn Rand. and I thought, that's okay stuff. But she had many opinions beyond the importance of liberty. And I think that in the political sphere, I'm only interested in liberty. How you lead your life is a separate issue. That you should be free to lead your life as you wish is step one. Step two is people giving you advice on how you should lead a good life as opposed to a free life.
This is an interesting distinction because, we talked about coherence before. There are different strains in the conservative movement in this country today. Not all of them would express themselves as you just did. And I know you're a convener of many elements of the coalition, the conservative coalition. How long have you been having these Wednesday meetings?
We started the first Wednesday meeting in early 1993. Somebody had suggested to me that we should have a coalition to think how to try and stop Hillary care from being implemented when Bill Clinton was president, and Hillary was going to be in charge of managing more government control of health care. And as we put it together, we started about 20 people, and we realized that if you were going to stop Hillary care, you had to slow everything down. And so the drive for the stimulus spending, who would help us fight that, the Second Amendment questions, all of the various parts of the conservative movement were brought together. And within a couple of months, we self-consciously had a broad center-right coalition and about 40 people. Today, it's somewhere between 150 and 180 meet. And we meet every Wednesday, 10 to 11:30, rain or shine, not the week between Christmas and New Year's, but every other Wednesday.
So don't show up, conservatives, if between Christmas and New Year's, if you want to join.
That's the one week we won't be there. But what makes that meeting work is that people talk for 3 minutes. We now have 30 people present for 3 minutes and an hour and a half about what they're doing, not what their hopes and aspirations are, not how deeply they care about something, not whining about why somebody else didn't do their homework for them. What are they doing moving forward, not backward? And that keeps the conversation about the future, about action and what you're doing. And it also creates a virtuous cycle where the more people are doing, the more they present. The less people are doing, the less they present. So in the room, the more active people are talking more often.
And it's like, is it like open mic night where anybody can step up if they have something to say?
Yes and no, but you have to plan ahead. So Candace Boyer, who works with me, you send her an email, say, Candace, I want to talk about this on this Wednesday. It gets on the agenda. I, during the week, when I run into people, whenever I see somebody with a good project or a good thing, I say, could you present on that on a Wednesday? So I'm always looking for more people to present or to and the best way to get somebody to join the meeting is to have them present, look around and go, I want to be with these guys more often, and then they stay. So that's how you accumulate
folks. I want to pursue this. I don't want to lose the sequence of your sure. your story, but the reason I raised it only was because of this concept of not telling people how to live their lives, because you've invited, for example, the Log Cabin Republicans, a gay Republican organization, to participate
several
in these meetings.
GL Proud,
yeah. So, your wife Samaa is Muslim,
mm-hmm.
So. This is the incoherent part. This is the part that
this is the part you don't understand.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yes. Well, but I will when you explain it to me.
Good. So, that's what we're here for.
No, but yeah. I mean, how do you bridge these fairly large chasms?
Yeah. That is a very good question, and a whole bunch of people on the right don't understand this. This is not an easy concept. What makes the meeting work, and what we've realized as we were doing it, is that everybody in the center right is there because on their vote moving issue, not all issues, their vote moving issue, what they want from the government is to be left alone. So you have some on the quote unquote religious right, evangelical Protestants, conservative Catholics, Orthodox Jews, Mormons, Muslims, people from the most important thing in their life is practicing their faith and passing it on to their children. Now, if you then ask them questions 3, 4, 5, and 7, some people will tell you, well, I don't like what people in San Francisco do on Saturdays. Okay. What do you vote on? I vote on wanting to be left alone so that I can go to heaven because I understand scripture and everybody else gets it wrong. So as long as you guarantee and protect the people in the coalition, their primary vote moving issue, they're part of the team. They don't walk away if they don't also get that they have other theories they may want to talk about or work on. But you go around the room. The Second Amendment folks, the gun owners, hunters, people want concealed carry permits, they want to be left alone with their gun rights. They don't want you to have a gun. They don't want you to be a hunter. They don't want to tell you what to do. They want to be left alone. The homeschoolers want to be able to educate themselves. They don't knock on your door and tell you to homeschool. They don't want the government to make anybody else homeschool. The businessmen and women who want to be left alone to practice and run their own professional and business lives, self-employed people, independent contractors, taxpayers. If you vote on this issue, what you want is to be left alone by the government. Now, you can ask people, secondary, tertiary, quaternary, or whatever five is, questions.
You and then lost you, me at three.
And then, then you can get all sorts of arguments, okay? I'm on the board of directors of the National Rifle Association. I know gun people who have, in my view, the oddest views of free trade with China. But they don't vote on free trade. They vote on the Second Amendment. So it's not necessary to have an argument with them about the virtues of free trade. People are in on their vote-moving issue.
What is necessary is that we take a break right
sure.
now. We'll be right back with Grover Norquist. So on this point of being left alone, and then I do want to get back to your narrative, what about on issues like abortion, gay rights, and so on? Because certainly gay Americans would say we should be free, and you obviously feel that way as well. We should be free to live our lives and have the same rights as everyone else to live our lives. Women, I think the abortion issue is a difficult issue, but there's a strong feeling among women that these are decisions they should make with their doctors and family.
Yeah.
And
those
and
are the
clergy.
Two questions. Yeah, you raised the two points that people do when I explain the modern center-right the modern Reagan Republican Party. It's a collection of people who, on their vote-moving issue, wish to be left alone. What does that mean about abortion, and what does that mean about gay rights? I think on gay rights, you saw the melting of the opposition to the idea of gays being able to lead lives and being left alone. It happened rather quickly, as things happen historically, because the people who had questions or objections to that, it wasn't a vote-moving issue for them. It wasn't a vote-moving issue. They might have said, well, if you asked me what I think, I'll tell you. I'm against X. You didn't ask if I vote on that. And, I mean, name somebody who lost an election over the subject.
That is a change, though, because there was a time when that you know, I remember in 2004 mm-hmm. that the Republican Party put anti-gay marriage initiatives on the ballot in some mm-hmm. states to try and up turnout among evangelical voters.
Didn't happen, though. When you look 2004, matter of fact, the increase in Republican turnout in every one of those states was it was a general 3-point up for Bush. And the only states where that appeared maybe would happen would be Utah and Louisiana, neither of which were contested states in the presidential election. The other states actually went the other way.
But that
I looked into that at the time because I was writing a book about all of these issues. And I said, is that a vote-moving issue that went along partisan lines? The turnout didn't do that. It didn't
But the theory was that it
Theory might. Was, yeah. yeah. That wasn't my theory, though.
No, I understand that.
Somebody else's theory didn't work. Sorry for that.
So you feel free to talk about it.
I was right.
Okay. Noted.
Yes.
Well, and what about the issue of abortion?
Well, that's different because the question on abortion is not whether people should have rights or not. It's a question of how many people there are. I mean, I don't know anyone who says there are two people and you should be able to kill one. And I don't know anybody who thinks there's only one person and you should make her have a baby. So the question is, are there two people? If they are, they both have rights. If there's only one person, then she has rights. So that's not a political question. It's a theological or scientific question. And that's why, unlike other issues, there are pro-life Democrats and there are pro-choice Republicans. But other issues are sorting out much more than that one does.
Let's go back to your narrative because you're the convener of this mm-hmm. Of this consortium of organizations on the right, as the founding leader of Americans for Tax Reform, mm-hmm. you came into that through the government. Actually, Ronald Reagan recruited you mm-hmm. to put an organization together to help rally people behind the tax reform of 1986. How did that come about?
Well. Obama set up what, Organizing for Change, Organizing for America?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Reagan set up, the Reagan administration guys set up Americans for Tax Reform. They put together a board, they put together a budget, and then asked me to run it. And our goal was, this was in 85, and our goal was to pass what became the 1986 Tax Reform Act. And in organizing that, and before I'd run the National Taxpayers Union between college and business school, and I'd been involved in taxpayer issues for some time back in Massachusetts, Prop 2.5 there. So there, we set this up, and then during the 2006 year, I realized we had a challenge. Some Republicans fear that if you reduced rates and broaden the base, eliminate deductions and credits, that having lost the protection of deductions and credits, that the rates would creep back up again. How does one minimize the danger of that? And that's where the Taxpayer Protection Pledge came from. It was designed specifically to help pass the 86 bill, to say we got 100 congressmen and 20 senators to sign, two witnesses, dated, signed. I will vote against any and all efforts.
Does it have to be notarized? Or,
We don't ask for notarization, but perhaps someday. Right now, we've only had one real problem. That was George Herbert Walker Bush. Everybody else has been
We'll get to that. But I read somewhere that this idea of a no tax pledge was one that you'd been mulling around since you were 12 years old or something.
Well, sort of. What it was when I was 12, a young person, I was on a bus coming back from school, and the teachers had been berating us, saying, democracy doesn't work. Nobody knows who their state legislator is. People vote for nothing. They don't know. And I thought, well, I don't know who my state legislator is, and And I understand not everyone knows who their congressman is because the teacher was giving us statistics on this subject. So, but what if the Republican Party became the party that would never raise your taxes and would brand itself that way? Then, if you could maintain quality control, then you might be able to get close to 50% based on party affiliation because the party would mean something. And then to get to win, you go campaign a lot, talk about other issues, and so on. I thought that that would be a good base for a party that said, you know, vote for the Republican. He may invade small countries you can't pronounce, or he can't pronounce, but he won't raise your taxes. And I said, that's close to 50%. But when I was 12...
Leaving aside the question of how you pay for the invasion of the small country if you don't have...
Yes, well, I'm not sure I was advocating invading small countries, just pointing out they might do that on your behalf.
This came up at times, you know.
It has, yes. So that was the thought, but when I was 12, no one was paying any attention to my thesis, and it was after we got the pledge going for
Where do you
this
go with that when you're 12, by the way? Who do you write with these ideas?
That would have been a good idea. It just stuck with me, but didn't go anywhere, and I didn't have any radio talk shows to chat with. But then when I created the pledge for the 86 election, I realized that we had now begun the process of branding the modern Republican Party because we had, you know, just about half of the House and Senate committed to never, not in the next year, never, as long as I'm in office, voting for a net tax increase. That meant the next tax reform would be that much easier because we'd have protection against it becoming a hidden tax increase. And then we built from there.
Yeah, so talk about that, because it seems to me when you talk about the evolution of the modern sort of Republican primary conservative movement, a lot of it happened in that sort of 1988-1990 time frame where you had the decision of then-President Bush to embrace a tax increase to try and balance the budget after having said no new taxes in his...
And signed the pledge.
In convention speech. At the same time, Newt Gingrich was emerging in the House as a kind of leading an insurrection against Bob Michael and the Republican House leadership that was more moderate and embraced Bush's tax. How seminal was that one event, that fight over the Bush tax increase?
It was central, but it also came at the right time. When Reagan came into Washington, D.C., he was one of a handful of Reagan Republicans in Washington. There are only a few congressmen or senators who would have defined themselves as Reagan Republicans, maybe Laxalt. So after 8 years and then 10 years, 88, 90, you had a bunch of congressmen and senators retire, and then you had new congressmen and senators. It's, you know, nobody changes their mind, people die. So it wasn't just that people in Washington looked around and changed their mind, it's that people who'd grown up pre-Reagan died, retired, moved on, and new people who came into political action and paying attention to what's going on in politics, living through Carter's failures and Reagan's successes, and goes, I'm with him. I'm with that guy. That's what it means to be a Republican today. When I grew up, Reagan was the right wing of the Republican Party beyond the pale, as far as Massachusetts was concerned. And then he became the modern Republican Party, or the modern Republican Party adopted his worldview. Then you had Bush, who was losing in 1988 by 14 points, when I had to go to my Harvard reunion and face all the Dukakis supporters mocking me for supporting this Yale guy.
Well, you got even, didn't you?
Well, he did win, but he was down 14 points, and then he said, read my lips, no new taxes. He said, I'm going to govern as Reagan. And then Reagan won a third term, unfortunately.
Bush. Yeah, you're right.
Bush got in when Reagan won the third term.
There was another element there, which is that Roger Ailes ran a brilliant negative campaign in the summer of 1988 against Dukakis, to which Dukakis replied feebly. Yeah. And then the big debate screw-up of Dukakis. So that certainly was part of it,
yeah.
But there were other elements of what happened.
Yeah, no, no, there were many. But Bush, if he'd not said, I'm going to govern and run as Reagan, I don't think would have been competitive. He started behind. And so he did get elected in 88, promising not to raise taxes. Then in 90, he raised taxes and dramatically increased spending. So he writes in his books about how he was raising taxes in return for spending cuts. Spending rose more that after the tax increase than it was scheduled to go before the tax increase. The tax increase fed spending increases. So he raised taxes, increased the debt, increased spending, all of which was punished in 1992 when he lost to a little-known guy out of Arkansas.
What did you do in the Pat Buchanan was running in 92. Where were you in the 92 race? Did you play an active role?
Not particularly. I was at the, I've been at a lot of the conventions helping on the platform stuff. Oh, yes, oh dear. I was at the platform. And we had this discussion. And I was overseeing as the political commissar for the tax and spending part of the.
I know you guys had commissars over there.
I don't think they call us that. Oh. But your job was to report back to Central to see if any of the officers were conspiring against you and wanted to make their own decisions or something. And I had allowed in to the text, meaning I hadn't objected. I mean, I didn't have a vote. These are the delegates, right? And they said it was the tax increase was a mistake and we're against tax increases. Bush had the previous week said the tax increase was a mistake. So I get a call middle of the night from Jim Ciccone, James Baker's deputy. What are you doing? I'm sleeping. Why? And they said it was a mistake. I said, the president said it was a mistake. Only the president is allowed to say that the president made a mistake. So the next day they had to walk it back and they had these congressmen who had been there. I mean, Vin Weber was part of this. I didn't think I was letting something slide that was a secret, that it was a mistake.
Bush himself wrote in his diary that he thought when he signed that tax increase that he probably was consigning himself to one term.
Hard to think he believed that because he turned to Sununu and asked if it would be okay, and Sununu said he'd cover for the right. And his first reaction was not to go along with the tax increase. But Darman was the smartest man in the world and talked him into it. But Darman didn't pay the penalty. Darman didn't lose his job over this. Bush did. Look, no one's life is a complete waste. Some people serve as bad examples. And George Herbert Walker Bush is the guy who made this sacrifice. And in 94, we had ivory soap percentages of the modern Republican Party, House and Senate, taking the pledge. And we've had 90% of Republicans and senators taking the pledge ever since. And the modern Republican Party has become the party that will not raise your taxes.
Under any circumstance, for any purpose.
Yeah, because when you look at
So if there's a national emergency, if there's a war, or are there other things that – is there anything that you could conceivably think of that would be – that would merit raising taxes or raising new revenue?
The federal government takes 18-19% of GDP in taxes. And the amount of money that it misspends or spends on less important things. If something's an emergency, it's more important than the day-to-day projects of the day. Or it's not.
But most of it is spoken for in entitlement commitments and in interest on the debt. So the flexibility is a little less than you suggest, right?
No, because Congress can change anything they want to. I mean, if you're talking about an emergency, if the Noah and the flood, that Canada attacks us so viciously as they often threaten to do, what were you talking about? The necessity.
Well, I think. Well, let me ask you this: I don't know. In Bartlett's book of famous quotations, mm-hmm. by now, if it isn't, it probably should be. Your quote when you said, "My goal is to cut government in half." In 25 years to get it down to the size where we can drown it in the bathtub.
Yeah, that's the whole quote. That's good. Some people only do the second half.
Yeah. Well, that's the virtue of a 60-minute conversation. You can do the whole thing. But explain it to me.
Sure. First of all, federal government spends about 20% of GDP. And I think we could take that down dramatically over 25 years, two ways. One is the cost, the deadweight cost of government is spending as a percentage of the economy. If the economy, if we had the present government, the economy was twice as big, the government would not be as difficult for people to pay for. It wouldn't be as oppressive to people in the way it operated, and it wouldn't slow economic growth. So a bigger horse, you can carry the same package a lot more easily. And so 1 in 25 years, if you grow at 4% a year instead of 2% a year, you dramatically increase the size of government. And spending as a percent of GDP without changing the amount of money you're spending or allowing spending to go up with inflation has dropped significantly. We had taken
4% is a, but it's a hard number to maintain.
Those are Reagan's numbers. You can do 4%. We've done it in the past.
There are a lot of economists who would question that.
Yes, and at the end of the Carter years and at the end of the Obama years, left of center economists announced it's the end of growth. It's limits to growth. We were told that at the end of Carter, and then we had Reagan's 4% growth. We'll see, but I think if we get anything that looks like Trump's tax cut, 15% corporate rates, and his approach towards regulations or deregulation, his choices to run the FDA and the FTC and the FCC and FERC are going to dramatically reduce the regulatory burden by hundreds of billions of dollars in the economy. I think we can do very well on economic growth, and it's better to grow away from overspending than to have to cut it, but also you don't cut government spending, you reform it so it costs less.
We had two big, huge tax cuts, which you were in favor of course, in the 2000s, and significant deregulation, when President Bush left office, the economy was shrinking at 8.9%. Mm-hmm. Percent. So what happened?
Fannie and Freddie Mae did exactly what conservatives said would happen to Fannie and Freddie Mae, and they went bankrupt, and we had a crash. It had nothing to do with the tax cuts, but you're right. Look at the two tax cuts. The first one was a bunch of tax credits out, which did reduce the pressure to spend. But the second one was the pro-growth tax cut. That was the cut in the dividends and the cut in capital gains. And during that period, you saw growth jump over 3% for 4 years in a row. And the government's revenue was higher at the end of 4 years than the government had projected with no tax cut, and significantly higher than the CBO projected with a tax cut. So actually, that is one tax cut that actually paid for itself. It was Bush's responsibility. He failed to focus on Fannie and Freddie. Those things should be broken into 10 different pieces and sold off. The good news is that the Trump people get that. We can't ever let that happen again.
We're going to grow our revenues for a minute here, and we'll be right back with Grover Norquist. I don't want to revisit all of that history, but it seems a little bit myopic to say it was just Fannie and Freddie.
Without
Fannie and Freddie, when AIG didn't have any capital reserves to cover the bets that they were insuring, when you had corporations that were that banks that you were able to lever 20-1, sometimes 50-1. And they were allowed to do that by regulators. And when you had these products that were not well understood zipping around in the financial markets, I mean, did that not have something to do with what happened?
Well, you also had when Clinton was when they were doing the banking stuff during the Clinton years, they were requiring people to make bad loans in order to do mergers. So you had the deregulation with the, but we won't let you merge unless you do all the bad loan stuff, and reducing the amount of capital you had to buy houses. I mean, that was the way over leveraging part. If we'd skipped on that, we wouldn't have had the challenge. But that's what needs to get fixed.
Let me just ask you philosophically, and then I want to talk to you about Donald Trump and this tax cut. Are there things that government does that you think are worthwhile or important?
Sure. I'm sorry. We back on stage?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Yes. I think it's important to have a national defense, keep the Canadians on their side of the border, protect the borders of the United States. And I think it's important to have a judicial system that's not corrupt and functioning to enforce the rule of law. We should have prisons for people who commit violent crimes, not for people who we dislike. And beyond that, the government should protect people's rights to live their own life as they see fit. And that's a...
What about public education? Should we have... You were the beneficiary, you said, of good schools in Western Massachusetts. Should there be public schools?
Right now, we talk about where do we go from here. I think every parent...
I'm just asking sort of philosophically, is that a place where government should be?
Well, but there's a difference between should everybody be fed and should the government run the farms, okay? Should the government require you to go to the school that they assign you to, or should have parents have the rights to say, if we're going to collectively spend $5,000, $10,000 per child on education, can a parent decide to go to a Catholic school if they're Catholic?
Yeah, but that's a different issue. Should there be public schools, or should it be an entirely private pursuit, education?
Right now, it seems to me that you allow, if you were to allow a public school to compete with homeschooling, parochial schools, private schools, charter schools, and so on. That
well, there are places where there are charter schools. There are charter schools in a lot of places, including here. And
a lot of them do. And it's the interesting question is, if you only have the charter school as an option, they've been closing Catholic schools around here as people go into charter schools, because you can't get the voucher to go to parochial schools. So they've been starving the religious private schools in Chicago and other major cities. So I think step back and say, how do you maximize liberty? And I think the most important thing we can do is let every parent choose. This is what education savings accounts do now, passed in a number of states. Indiana has pretty much vouchers for everybody, and they're building that in Wisconsin. You're seeing that in Arizona. I would leave it up to parents to decide whether they want to go to a religious school, a public school, what kind of private school, secular private schools, and have that. I think that's the most important education reform. I think that's much more important than controlling what kids read.
Government should, there should be some assurance that a child can go to school.
Yeah. I mean, just we could figure out how much you're spending per child and then let the parents decide
where they go to school.
Yeah, I'm not arguing for no taxes. Okay. The question is, do private schools cost less than public schools? Do they have wildly fewer bureaucrats working for them? The number of bureaucrats at Catholic school system in New York versus the New York school system.
Those are worth looking at. A whole nother hour we could spend on that. What about infrastructure? You know, we're in the land of Lincoln here. And Lincoln, even during the Civil War, laid the seeds for the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad. He started the National Science Foundation. He started land-grant colleges on the theory that we needed an infrastructure, a modern infrastructure, to grow the economy and maximize people's opportunities in that economy, education, that we needed to be on the edge of innovation, and basic science needed to happen that might not have an immediate applicability, and so on. Are those legitimate pursuits of government? I mean, infrastructure, for example, is that something government should invest in?
Well, you have the railroads were built with private money. The government granted land to people. I think probably would have been wise to sell it since people got rich with those railroads. But as we did make land available to people.
You're not opposed to people getting rich?
No, but not if the government's giving them a subsidy. That's not acceptable.
Right, we agree on that.
But looking at the present situation, we have a whole bunch of – we've just had 8 years of a war on infrastructure where efforts to build pipelines were stopped by the EPA and by the government. We're now finally finished that pipeline, the North Dakota Access Pipeline. I was up in North Dakota. That increases the value of every barrel of oil in North Dakota, by $3 to $4. It means a lot to the state of North Dakota. It means a lot to the people of North Dakota. And that was held up for political reasons And thousands and tens of thousands of people were damaged because of that. That pipeline that now comes down through Nebraska, the Keystone Pipeline, is going to provide energy assurance from Canada. You don't have to buy your energy from dangerous places.
Well, a lot of that oil is going to get shipped overseas. But on the infrastructure question,
but now we have a pipeline.
On the infrastructure question, though,
pipelines,
we've got $2.2 trillion of infrastructure needs. That's what the civil engineers say, bridges and roads, and we can see it. Everybody can see it in their communities. Presumably, and during the Obama years, he called for infrastructure investments that Congress didn't do it. Now President Trump is calling for $1 trillion in infrastructure investments. Are you supportive of that?
I am supportive of dramatically improving our infrastructure. Starting, we have $1.3 trillion of waterworks that need to be replaced, sewage water and, and drinking water. There are state laws, Chicago has some of the worst laws on this, which mandate how you make the pipes, because 100 years ago this made sense, and they didn't have plastic. And they're now in cities that have open competition for big metal pipes or plastic pipes, it costs about 25 to 28% less for every mile that you do this stuff.
But Grover, leaving the efficiency, it's still going to cost something.
There's a difference between $1.3 trillion and $1 trillion.
Yeah, there
is. $380 trillion.
Dollars. Trillion bucks is still a lot, even in today's day and age.
That's over the next 30, 40 years that you have to do that. Go to roads. The Davis-Bacon Act raises the cost of all roads unnecessarily by about 20%. It was a racist law.
But you still need money to build roads.
But I'm giving you 20% more roads by getting rid of a racist law from the 1930s designed to keep black people from working in the North. And that law should be repealed because it's ugly, and that law should be repealed because it loots taxpayers. Then another 20% of your road taxes are diverted into non-road stuff, which is either questions of subways or other things that aren't roads, but a whole series of when you pay your gas taxes, a lot of that money is taken out, doesn't go to gas taxes. It goes to the Davis-Bacon Act. It goes to non-roads. So when people say, I want more roads, the answer is that's not what politicians give you when you give them gas tax money. They give you other stuff. Wisconsin, before Walker came in, the 10 years before Wisconsin, the Democrats took $1 billion out of roads and spent on other things.
But Grover,
they turned around and said,
are you saying that we should have infrastructure improvement and repairs, but we can do it all through reform mechanisms, and there's no new revenue necessary for it?
No, you don't need new revenue. When we're talking about overspending by 20 to 40%, you could get 20 to 40% more highways, more roads, more pipes by getting rid of corrupt laws and wasteful laws. And pipelines and railroads and refineries. There's a lot of stuff to be done here.
There is a lot of stuff to be done. I mean, I worry about it. I worry about
the fact that
we don't have a 21st century infrastructure. And it's in some cases dangerous when you have bridges collapsing. And, today I saw a Department of Energy tunnel collapsed with nuclear material in it. So when the president says we should spend $1 trillion more, you don't agree with that.
No, actually, if you look at the president's campaign website and his writing sense, he's talking about $1 trillion and about two-thirds plus of that is private money that he wants to leverage with taxpayer dollars. So it's not $1 trillion for the appropriators to go
and spend. He were to say, I want to invest $1 trillion of tax money in infrastructure, would you be supportive of that?
You'd have to look at, one, the timetable over what period $1 trillion. And two, are we paying off special interests and we're spending the money, but we're spending it so poorly that we could, with the amount of money we have today, get the same product?
Let me just assert that I think that we should be assiduous about how we spend tax dollars. But I also don't think that we can hide behind that fig leaf and say we can repair $2.2 trillion of needed repairs in this country is in, as you point out, water systems, railroads, airports, roads, bridges. And it actually would be good for the country to engage in that from an economic standpoint, because right now you've got record profits, corporate profits. You've got people doing very, very well at the top mm-hmm. end of our economy, and I don't begrudge them that. But what's really needed is an infusion of energy among the middle class.
Absolutely.
And infrastructure would be one way. A major investment in infrastructure would be a way to do it. What about like basic science and the investments of government in labs around the country to do basic research that doesn't have, as Lincoln recognized, immediate benefit to some for some remunerative purpose, but ultimately might lead to great discoveries that have enormous implications. That's a role the government has played since that time, and it's been a positive role. But is that an appropriate role in your view?
I think when you look at any of these questions, you say, what are the things the government's doing that get in the way of achieving the stated goal by politicians? Oh, I want to do this. And when you offer the politicians a way to get there that gives people more freedom and lower taxes, they go, no, I didn't mean that. I wanted more control. All of the infrastructure stuff that you're talking about, that look at the governors and the Senate who, they don't spend the extra dollar on infrastructure. They spend it on other things. Infrastructure is what they hold hostage. Roads are what they hold hostage to say, you give me money, I'll give you roads. But you don't give me money, I'm not giving you more roads. When a politician said he won't do infrastructure or roads unless you give him more money and taxes, he's telling you that everything in the present budget is more important to him than roads are, that roads are his least priority, the lowest priority that he has. And that's quite true. For most of these politicians, roads is the lowest priority, and that's why they don't do the bridges, and that's why they don't do the dikes, and they don't do these things, because they're spending the money on other things to get themselves elected.
In our state has an enormous budget deficit here in Illinois. There are other states like that as well. I mean, there are real human implications to that. Or is there an irreducible core you think we could reach where you would say, yeah, we are doing everything the way it should be done, and we can't pay for the infrastructure that we need, or we can't pay for the education that we need, or we can't pay for the basic scientific research that we need, and we need more money? I mean, is there any level at which, or is it just your assumption that we're always going to be inefficient and therefore there's always a place to find the money?
Well, first of all, you start by fixing the problems that we have. 20% of gas tax money is diverted out of roads. Stop that. Another 20% goes to Davis-Bacon. Stop that. When you fix that, come and talk to me about whether you might need more money. But no discussions about more money while you're pissing away 40%
of it. So the answer is yes, that you think that there's some level at which you reach the point where you say, yeah, we've done everything that we should, and we still need some more, and so we're going to ask for it.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. The other thing we have to look at in a country the size of the United States is we have trillions of dollars of value in land and things under the land and under the water around. The government can sell off a lot of property and a lot of the mineral and gas rights offshore as well as on federal land, as is done on private land and on state land, which tremendously increases jobs and opportunities. And you can use that to pay down debt or buy other things. There's a whole series of project lines where the government could devolve itself of assets. So taking a look at the military spending, the Calvert bill would reduce the number of civilian Pentagon employees. They're 700,000. We haven't reduced the civilian bureaucracy since the end of the Cold War, or since we won the Cold War. The other team didn't quit. They lost. But then take a look at what we could do in terms of bringing the number of bureaucrats down as we've dropped the number of uniformed soldiers, sailors, and airmen. If we bring it back to just 2,000 ratios, tooth to tail, you could save about $160 billion over a decade. So we've got an awful lot more guys in the bureaucracy of the Pentagon than you need. You could do that through attrition. Calvert has a bill to do that. McCain tells me it'll go into his bill as well. So there's a lot of savings to be made. And I think we should focus on that rather than trying to get into people's pockets for more.
Let me ask you before we go about about President Trump. You've said that you thought he could be the most fiscally conservative president in history. He's proposed a
recent history.
In modern history, you said, yeah. You You've seen his tax plan. It's sketchy, but you know mm-hmm. the basic outlines of it. Maybe you were consulted on it. He's also said that he doesn't want to, and those will, trillions of dollars of revenues will be stripped as a result of that. And I know that there's the theory that the economy will grow and you make that money back.
Some of it. You make some of it back.
But what about his commitment also to not to touch Social Security, Medicare? He's already now proposed cutting Medicaid by $880 billion. Yeah. But what about Social Security and Medicare? Do you support his position on that? And is that fiscally conservative?
Well, his commitment was not to do anything on Social Security. Social Security requires 60 votes because when they did the fix back in 83, they said, now take 60 votes. So you can't deal with Social Security. You can't reform Social Security or change it.
Because that's not what he didn't say. I'd love to do it, but I can't because I'm limited by
But you asked me
votes.
If I cared that he took it off the table, and I'm just saying no, because it's not on the table.
Okay.
I think we should have done what Bush wanted to do, was let young people take their FICA taxes and put it in a 401k. Other countries do this and have done very well with it.
But on Trump, because he's not going to do that.
Okay. I'm
just asking you if it's fiscally conservative.
On his position on Medicare, which is he doesn't want to change it for anybody who's on Medicare now, I just think that's politically sensible. At some point, I'd go with what Alice Rifkin and the Speaker of the House, Ryan, put together years ago to make that more competitive, to bring price. The two ways to keep prices down of a product. One is to have a government law that says here's wage and price controls, and the other is competition. And that would have introduced competition. As when Bush created that Part D on Medicare for drugs, that allowed a lot of competition, and it came in way under budget. You could argue it shouldn't have done it at all. I think it made sense the way they did it. But the way they kept prices down was to have competition, not to say, we say that this is the right price.
Yeah.
Monopolies don't do very well.
But I'm not asking you
better.
What Grover Norquist would do. I'm asking mm-hmm. you about what Trump said he would do, which is nothing. He said, I'm not going to touch Social Security.
For people
Medicare.
Who are on it now, yes.
He didn't say for people who are on now. He just said, I'm not going to touch it.
Okay. It is my understanding that it is both his position at the time and now that he's not talking about changing it for people who are on it now. If we don't change it for people who are under 55 or 50, the whole thing collapses in the next 20 years. So somebody needs to have a reform before the day is over.
Well, I know that the president begins every Monday and Thursday by listening to the Axe Files.
So good.
If he is listening,
good.
You just laid down a marker for him, and I'm sure he will act on it.
Well, there's lots of reforms to be done. I think the tax cut will be very helpful. Also important is the deregulation. The changes at the FCC for some time are going to be more important than the changes at the Supreme Court. That's 15% of the economy. The changes at the FDA. You want more investment in science and so on. Get the FDA.
So by deregulating all these industries, you think you'll get more growth, more investment. Just to close out. So yeah. you think that there will be lost revenue as a result of these tax cuts. You think the benefit of the tax cuts outweighs the loss to the government of the lost revenue?
It depends how you write them. The House bill is even on deficits out into the future. There are some changes that are not completely clear that Trump has. You can, if you grow at 4% a year for a decade instead of 2% a year for a decade, the government nets $5 trillion more, $5.5 trillion more than it would have with the 2% growth. So if you get substantial growth, you actually end up with a fair amount of additional revenue coming in. The other thing is when people get jobs, they also are not on welfare or welfare means-tested programs. So there is a savings as people move to self-sufficiency rather than dependency. But there's also more revenue comes in from more growth. The other thing is we've got $2.5 trillion, some people say more than that, trapped overseas until we get rid of our worldwide tax system and go to a territorial tax system and bring that money back. So I think $2 trillion, I don't think it all comes back, but $2 trillion flowing back in would be tremendously helpful to the economy, and then allowing that money to flow back regularly tax-free would create a lot of jobs and a lot of opportunity and really kickstart the economy in a helpful way.
I don't want to end on a provocative note, and I know this is you are steeped in this in ways that few others are, but this issue of what the president does on Social Security and Medicare, and I'm not necessarily encouraging him to take an axe to Social Security and Medicare, but what he does on that and this if, this asterisk that you put on the tax cut, that if we grow at 4%, mm-hmm. those don't seem conservative to me. Those seem very much as a risky bet. But what I'm going to do is this, is I'm going to book you right now for 2027 on May, whatever the day is, and we'll be able to review what happened over the last decade.
That will be fun. Look forward to it.
Grover Norquist, thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.